Dear Mr. Potter, we are pleased to inform you that you have been accepted at Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry.
You're a wizard, Harry.
I'm a what?
A wizard, and a thumping good one, I'd wager, once you trade up a little.
No, I can't be a wizard. I mean, I'm just Harry.
Welcome to Now Playing Podcast's bonus Wizarding World of Harry Potter retrospective series.
Mr. Potter, our new celebrity.
The boy who lived, come to die.
Hosted by Brock.
Well, I'm sure we'd all be fascinated to hear what you have to say.
Stuart.
You won't last 2 seconds if he invades your mind.
And Arnie.
Why is it when something happens, it is always you three?
Believe me, Professor. I've been asking myself the same question for 6 years.
But be warned, this episode will contain detailed plot spoilers and strong language.
Now, there's absolutely nothing for you to worry about.
Tell me, has anyone ever believed you?
You told them not to worry?
Well, my philosophy is that worrying means you suffer twice.
Listener discretion is advised.
You wait till my father hears about this.
We hope you enjoy the show.
Do enjoy yourself, won't you? While you can.
Today we're talking about Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, Part 1, starring Daniel Radcliffe, Rupert Grint, Emma Watson, Helena Bonham Carter, Robbie Coltrane, Warwick Davis, Ray Fiennes, Michael Gambon, Brendan Gleeson, Richard Griffiths, John Hurt, Jason Isaacs, Alan Rickman, Fiona Shaw, Timothy Spall, Imelda Staunton, David Thewlis, Julie Walters, directed by David Yates. This is Brock. I'm saint-like. I'm holy. Do you get it?
Ed Stewart.
Morning. This is Arnie.
Welcome to, I want to say the last, but it's not the last movie in the Harry Potter retrospective series. We are doing part one of the Deathly Hallows because they decided that they needed to do parts one and part two of the final Harry Potter book. And I guess that is something we need to talk about right off the top, why they did parts one and parts two instead of doing one long movie.
They're the first, right? They're the first of the money-hungry studios to realize they're out of books and need to do more. Because I looked this up. I mean, we've already reviewed The Hunger Games, but they split that up later. I knew Twilight did it, but Twilight did it later. I know that The Hobbit, for Christ's sake, I think The Hobbit's the one that killed it all, right? I mean, we're going to do three movies out of one. I didn't even remember. I know nothing about the Divergent series, but I guess Divergent did this too.
They never finished, actually. They never even made the last part.
But this, as far as I can tell, other than like Kill Bill, where Tarantino just didn't want to cut the movie down, as far as saying we have one book left and we want to make two movies money out of it, these are the pioneers.
And why is that? I mean, like, I think we've all said Order of the Phoenix suffered because it was an 850-page book, had a lot going in those pages, and it got reduced to the shortest runtime, like a little bit over 2 hours and 15 minutes for that length. Meant that you had a very scattered movie.
The words they like to use is creative imperative. They additionally didn't want to do it, but they sat down and figured, how are we going to make this movie? And then they started spitting it like, we want to do justice to Rowling's words. And could you think of anything that you could cut from this book that we could tell a coherent story? And all these characters need their moments.
Yes.
Join us at Books and Nachos.
Yes.
I can.
Yes. So indeed, do you need two parts for this story? Both of these movies are their own things. We're going to be talking about the first one. I think next podcast, when we do part two, I think it's going to be easier to compare the second one to the first one after having discussed the first one. But I'm just going to throw this out there to you. We talked a lot about in the first two movies how they were overly loyal to the books and the movies suffered. This movie is, gosh, it feels like very little was cut from the first half of this book. But actually, this particular movie, which is 2.5 hours long, is about 2/3 of the book. It's not split in half directly.
And I'm just going to say that that's how I experienced it. I read 550 pages and I stopped and I watched the first movie. So I saw this movie not knowing how it was going to end.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. I, for this viewing, having seen it before and read the book before, knowing where this movie ended, I read up into that part and watched the movie with my daughter and then finished the book.
Yeah. I figured, like, if we're breaking it up, I shouldn't have that preconceived notion of, you know, Hermione taking over the school and Ron dying and everything that I think is going to happen.
And I've never seen these films before. I did break out my 3D glasses for this. This was a 3D theatrical release.
The whole movie this time? Not just the chair?
The whole movie.
Okay.
But wasn't it post-converted, though? It wasn't like, because Avatar came out and made so much money, right, that they decided that to do these two as 3D, right? This is post-Avatar, clearly.
Yeah, Avatar came out in Christmas 2009. This is Thanksgiving 2010. I would think they'd already be in production, so yeah, probably some post-conversion.
Oh, this is interesting. Brock, I look to you as the fan, but this was not in theaters in 3D.
Yeah, okay.
Because they didn't have time to do the film conversion.
There you
mm-hmm.
go.
The 3D version was a Best Buy exclusive.
Oh.
But the second one came out in 3D, I believe.
Yes. So there you go. This explains everything. Because I'll tell you right now, the 3D in this movie sucked. And I've watched both movies back to back. The 3D in part two was great. And so I was like, what happened here? Why was part one so bad that I just felt like everything was dim? And in part two, things are popping off the screen. I mean, not even the snake popping at the screen was a good 3D effect in this one. And I thought if anything was going to be, it was going to be that. So, okay, this all makes sense now.
I was just going to ask you that. What about the snake when he comes out in the cabin? Interesting. I did not see this movie in the theaters. Again, we had the baby at home, so we didn't get to the theater for this one. We watched it when it came out the following 6 months later or whatever, did on DVD and home video, and watched it at home in the comfort of our home while the baby was sleeping. So my streak ended with part five, and we were happy that we didn't go and rush out to see this one, especially since we missed six in the theater.
And it's David Yates again, same director for his third. I mean, they shot this all at once. They broke it up as two movies, but he's tackling it as one big event. So his third and fourth franchise efforts are here, but with a new cinematographer, a new composer. I guess he wears them out. I don't know why he has the stamina to keep going.
He has nothing else to do?
Maybe.
I could not find anywhere if they shot the first one in its entirety or when they're at locations, did they shoot parts of 1 and 2 like they did for, say, Superman 1 and 2 back in the day? Or like they shot that one scene for Revenge of the Sith when they were filming Attack of the Clones, that kind of thing. And I could not find any confirmation. So as far as I know, they did it pretty much in order, one movie then the next. But yes, they filmed it with one long, like 250-day shoot schedule, something crazy, like Lord of the Rings kind of length of time.
Yeah, nearly a year, basically, you know, yeah.
Yeah, and then they came back for reshoots in the Christmas before the second one came out because the King's Cross station scenes they weren't happy with. They redid that entire scene. So there you have that. But I was just surprised that they use words like cinema verite for this part one, and they're talking about documentary feel and steady cams, and we want to get that kind of raw feelings to it. So they're trying to take different chances to make this what they're calling all over the special features for the DVD and the Blu-ray and the all the stuff I've read from behind the scenes. The term a road movie keeps on coming up nonstop.
Yeah, I definitely noticed that they were not using tripods, that there's a lot of handheld running through the forest. You can't miss it, which again wouldn't be fun in 3D. Like, I wouldn't want to see something that shaky in 3D.
It was not fun. I'll say right now I had some problems with the shaky cam.
I'm kind of chomping at the bit here to get talking about this. So Arnie, how about we get a plot summary so we can dive into part one of the Deathly Hallows?
Harry Potter has no protection. Now 17 years old, an adult, the magic spells that protected Harry have expired, and his mentor, Albus Dumbledore, is dead. But he still has his friends Ron and Hermione, and Dumbledore left the three of them each an item to help on their quest. Hermione gets a book of children's stories. Ron gets Dumbledore's Deluminator that turns lights on and off, and Harry gets the snitch he caught in his first Quidditch game. The three set out in secret to finish Dumbledore's quest of finding Voldemort's 6 Horcruxes, of which 4 remain, each containing a piece of evil Lord Voldemort's soul. The only one which the trio know about is a locket, which had previously been taken from Voldemort's hiding place by someone with the initials R.A.B. It turns out that was Regulus Black, brother to Harry's deceased godfather Sirius Black. The locket was then stolen from Black's house by a thief named Mundingus. That thief then gave the locket as a bribe to former Hogwarts professor Dolores Umbridge, who now works at the Ministry of Magic as head of the Muggle-born Registration Commission. The three teens sneak into the Ministry of Magic and escape with the locket stolen from Umbridge's neck. But though they have the Horcrux, they have no way to destroy it. Camping in the woods with no clear plan, friction erupts between these three friends, and Ron leaves. Sometime later, in the night, a Doe Patronus appears and leads Harry to a lake, at the bottom of which is the Sword of Gryffindor, a magical item that can destroy Horcruxes. Harry dives for it but almost drowns until he's saved by Ron. Dumbledore's Deluminator showed Ron the way back to connect with his friends, and the trio are reunited. Using the sword, the locket is destroyed. Following a symbol drawn in Hermione's book, they seek answers from Luna Lovegood's father, Xenophilius Lovegood. He tells them of a children's tale found in Hermione's book of three brothers who faced death and each received a gift. The oldest brother got the Elder Wand, the most powerful wand in the world. Another brother received the Resurrection Stone, which can bring the dead back to life, but not in the same condition they left. The final brother gets a perfect invisibility cloak that no magic can penetrate. These three items are known as the Deathly Hallows. Harry realizes he already has one of these objects, the invisibility cloak left to Harry by his father. Voldemort is on the hunt for another. Frustrated by his stalemates fighting Potter, Voldemort seeks the Elder Wand. Xenophilius betrays Harry and company, hoping to secure his daughter's release by turning in Harry. Harry, Ron, and Hermione are taken to the home of Lucius Malfoy. When Bellatrix Lestrange sees the Sword of Gryffindor, which was supposed to be locked in the Lestrange vault, she begins to torture Hermione for information. Harry and Ron are thrown in the cellar, where they find Luna, Wandmaker Ollivander, and a goblin named Griphook. Desperate, Harry asks a mirror shard for help, and Dobby the house elf comes and teleports Harry and friends to safety. At the last moment, Bellatrix throws a knife at Dobby, who dies teleporting Harry to safety. Harry buries the house elf, and we see Voldemort gets the Elder Wand, taking it from the dead cold hands of Dumbledore's corpse, as credits roll.
So the movie, I have a laugh every time I watch this movie, right away. Because we're breaking this movie up into two parts because there's so much here that they insist we see. And what do? They start the movie with a scene that's not in the book. They have Scrimgeour, who is the new Ministry of Magic, who was in book 6, but not in movie 6. By the way, Bill Nye, who plays him, Bill Nye was cast to be in movie 6 playing this role. But since they cut that role out of the movie, they already had him signed up for this movie now. That opening scene is effective. It works. I just think it's weird that it really is not necessary because what they do is they intersperse it with where Ron and Hermione and Harry are at that moment and what they're doing to prepare for the oncoming onslaughts. But to have Scrimgeour open the movie was a weird and funny thing.
I would say that if you are trying to wrap things up, you don't want to introduce a whole lot of new characters in general. Like, it's the bad idea to have like 50 new characters at the end. If we didn't see this guy in the last movie, why don't we just keep Fudge? Like, we know who that is. To have it be Bill Nighy show up for a minute and then like later we're told like he's dead, like that just that didn't play.
Well, he has one more scene with the bequeathing, but yes, he dies. He doesn't die on screen, he dies in dialogue. Yeah, totally. But the scene that we do see here, because we only hear about it in the book, is Hermione erasing her parents' memory for their own safety.
I guess this is a heartbreaker for millennials. You know, for me, it was kind of like, yes, I get it. This is what she needs to do.
It was a fantasy. Face it. You wanted to run away a long time.
The only way to do it.
I wanted to erase my parents, not erase myself.
Explain to me how those pictures in their house make any sense with a person not in them.
We sure go to the zoo a lot as a couple without children.
I really thought that about the one that was just of Hermione, like in a chair, and it becomes a photo of a chair.
There's like a school photo or a JCPenney photo as the JCPenney background with nobody in front. I'm like, oh my God, it's terrible.
It's art.
Whose room is this upstairs?
I thought that was a good way to convey something that was kind of complicated in background. We hadn't seen Hermione's parents, and it's a big deal that they're muggles. So I think it's right that we get one moment, even if it's this late in the game, to see how she lives and that it's going to impact her. That leaving behind her, I almost want to say her earthly life, but her muggle life to go, you know, on this quest. It's a big deal for Hermione, but I don't know why it would be a big deal for Harry to see the Dursleys pack up and leave. This was kind of anticlimactic. I was really curious about how this was all going to end for them. I thought when he inherited the secret order of the Phoenix House, like that should have been the big FU goodbye. But instead, they almost want to make it seem sad for Harry that this family is packing up and leaving him at Privet Drive.
They really don't drive home in these movies that he has to go there for the magical protection, which is what's said in the book. And that protection expires when he turns 17, which is about to happen when we start. You know, I get it. You're just taking one book and splitting it into two movies. You can't possibly fit everything in. But I really did like the moment between Dudley and Harry that was in the book, kind of a reconciliation of these two cousins after all the years of animosity. I felt like they could have given Dudders his moment.
Well, they did. They filmed it. And they also filmed the scene with Fiona Shaw saying something to the effect of, "You didn't just lose a mother, I lost a sister." And she's completely cut out of the movie, right? Maybe she's in there for like a quick moment. That scene with Dudley, it's on the deleted scenes on the Blu-ray. It's very plotting. It doesn't really work well. So the moments there that we want, it's just not a good addition to put in the movie. It would really slow it down, especially in the beginning right here. You want to keep it moving a little bit. But yeah, he calls him Big D, the whole thing. It's right there from the book. It's a nice little scene, but I'm glad they cut it.
I'm surprised they didn't do director's cuts for any more of these films after, what was it, part two?
Yeah. Well, there actually is a scene where we have a James Bond Blofeld at the table moment with all the Death Eaters, and Snape arrives late to the party, and we see the Death Eaters around the table, Voldemort's there, and they have a teacher from Hogwarts floating upside down, clearly hurt, and the Malfoys already showing regret and remorse. It's at Malfoy Manor.
I thought that was Emma Thompson.
It was not Emma Thompson. It was another actress. I am not aware of who she is. Her character's name is Burbage. She teaches Muggle studies. I found this scene, her begging for her life, was sad. Nagini was a cool effect there. But Malfoy, especially Lucius Malfoy, looks like he's been on a bender. He is all scruffed up and things like that. I kind of like how they laid out the lay of the land of where they are, what they're doing. The new Minister of Magic is going to be there soon. We see him at the end of the table. Just basically saying the bad guys are in conference and they're going to go get Harry when they do that shell game. Also introduced here before, right before the shell game thing, is something that they completely cut out of the last movie. They introduced here, and I think of one of the only things that doesn't really make a lot of sense if you know what it is from the books. Harry has a shard of a mirror that he can see someone's in, and it's supposed to be from Sirius Black. He's supposed to be a gift from Sirius that he never got a chance to open when Sirius was alive. And they kind of explain it very poorly here in the movie, and it kind of continues into the next movie, but it's just really strange that they brought this mirror back in now and they didn't introduce it previously like they could have or should have.
It was very confusing to me where he got this shard, I'll be honest.
Yeah, it's out of the blue.
I thought it was from Dumbledore, so you're telling me it was Gary Oldman. Oh, who knew?
It's from Grimwald Place. It's a two-way mirror, and in the books it's much more explained. Here he just carries a shard around because he keeps seeing someone in it, but he can't figure out who it is. And in the book, again, it looks like Dumbledore because he has piercing blue eyes, but the eye looking back at him is brown, so it doesn't look anything like Dumbledore from the eye perspective. But I think that mystery is solved in the next movie, so we'll get there. But after the shard, the DA comes to take Harry, and we have a really fun scene here where they all decide, all these people here to protect Harry, to get him away.
Everyone's Harry Potter, and how will the Death Eaters figure out the real one as they move Harry to the safe house?
It's such a fun scene to see all these different actors get transformed in Daniel Radcliffe. There's seven of him running around, and comedy galore going on here, and Daniel Radcliffe seems like he's having a ton of fun with this.
I enjoyed the scene for what it was. I really love the scene where Fleur Delacour, who was supposed to be this like gorgeous supermodel woman, is now Harry and has to take off her bra. I thought that was amusing. But one question, why did seven of them have to turn into Harry instead of having Harry turn into somebody else?
That's a great question. I never thought of that.
Yeah. If you were trying to sneak somebody out, I don't know.
That's a great question. Gosh, yeah. Next time we have to escape, get Harry Potter, you should plan it instead of Mad-Eye Mooney. I do like the twins say, hey, we're identical. That was also very funny.
That was funny. I love the twins. The twins are like the underrated duo of this. They're like always in the background, always doing something clever. Really well cast, too.
Yeah, I agree. Instead of like Armie Hammer Social Network here, they actually have two people. It's not the Parent Trap. They actually got two people doing it.
I mean, they actually look alike.
So then they have the big action scene at the beginning of the movie, which breaks all sorts of visiting rules and laws by being on streets and in front of muggles and all that stuff.
But it answered your question from last time, Brock. You had such a problem with Harry Potter going on a broom ride at night and going through the Thames River, and you're like, but he's using magic. And they specifically call out here, brooms are not magic that can be traced by the ministry. So he could fly brooms all he wanted.
Okay, but my issue right now is that all these muggles are seeing not only the good guys, but the bad guys, and their property is being destroyed. Cars are crashing, things like that. So it's really all wizarding laws are being thrown out the window to start killing people.
But it's called Deathly Hallows, right? We want to die. I don't know if I wanted the owl to die. I don't know if we noticed that the owl dies, but Hedwig goes down here in the flurry of flying through the clouds.
Yeah, and Hagrid gets knocked out. A lot of people were not happy with Hedwig dying in the book, but again, it makes a lot of sense when we have the the rest of the movie we're going to talk about. If they had an owl to send messages back and forth, it would have been very convenient. So I guess they had to get rid of the owl so Harry doesn't have any attachments.
And Mad-Eye Moody is also dead.
Yeah, and George gets injured badly.
Who was Mundungus Fletcher? Like, where did this guy come from? Like, out of nowhere.
He was in previous books. They never used him before, but they decided to bring him back because of the locket later on. And honestly, they probably could have kept him out of here. They could have used, they have so many other characters, like, they could have had that could have transformed into a Harry. But instead, they had to go with Mundungus Fletcher and introduce a brand new character here who's a thief who steals things, blah, blah, blah. There could have been some other way to do it, to have the locket end up with Umbridge, then introduce this new character who really isn't necessary to the story, considering he hasn't been in anything else and they already decided to cut him.
Yeah, I knew him in the books, but when they're introducing him here, it is just kind of out of left field.
They also introduced Bill Weasley, who we haven't seen before, because they cut him out as well.
Yeah, it seems strange that he stayed at the Weasleys all this time, and I'm now just meeting another brother.
Yeah, and he's getting married, and we need to go to the wedding right now. Like, even though we gotta, like, run from Death Eaters in the sky, we need to take this moment.
And he marries a character we already know, right?
Yeah. I mean, you don't do this. If you didn't get it in the previous movies, it doesn't matter if it's in the book. You don't do it, because it doesn't make sense.
Right, so here we have the Mirror Shard, Mundungus Fletcher, and Bill Weasley. All these things have been cut out of previous movies, but here, because they have two movies, they're able to tell the story of the book closer, but find a way to, oh, hi, I'm Bill, I haven't met you before. Oh, hi, I'm Mundungus Fletcher, I haven't met you before. Oh, he has his glass. So, like, they're trying to fit it in at the beginning here so it makes more sense for later on so they can tell as closely to the book as possible because they have two movies to do it. And it's a little choppy in that sense. You don't really want to do that in part seven because, honestly, this whole movie and the next one, if you have not watched the other movies, there's no way you could follow this. Like, there's no way. You cannot come into this movie fresh. They're 100% assuming you've seen the other six movies before coming here, especially the previous movie. So there's no way. If this is anyone's first Harry Potter movie, sorry for you.
And I just want to put it out there. We won't release the books and nachos for another week, but I think that there are confusions throughout this book. Even someone that had been reading every book, when we get to this one, just there's a lot that they're trying to do. And 4 hours of movie or not, like, it just, things are not connecting here.
Yeah, they definitely need to introduce new things in the next two movies. We can't just get stale with all the stuff we've had. But by the same token, what they're introducing feels so shoehorned in and superfluous. And I agree with Harry. Harry's like, I need to get going. I need to get on the road. I need to find some Horcruxes. I have a mission. And yes, when they're like, but stay for the wedding. It's like, really? I mean, having read the book, I know at the wedding, they're going to see the symbol on Luna's dad, and that's going to be important. And again, the devotion to this book, the reason I felt they were doing two movies is for six movies, I'd heard people say they didn't include enough from the book. They took too much out of the book. Here's their chance, and they're putting it all in a way that feels very haphazard and very untrue to the six movies that have come before.
That's the thing. The six movies that came before. So this is very loyal to the book in a lot of ways, but we are doing the, and to borrow a terminology that we're using nowadays, the Harry Potter movie universe, right? So they are telling the same stories, they're adapting the book, and we've had talked about it in this series about how some of these movies adapted better than others, the book to a movie, but they're doing a movie version. And right now, to tell the movie, and right now to adhere closely enough to the book, they have to basically fix some omissions, or I want to say mistakes, but to reinsert some omissions that were definitely the more judicious ones to put back here. The wedding, what is the point of the wedding besides hearing Harry learn about the brother for the first time and seeing the symbol in the Deathly Hallows, to learn that where Luna lives? I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff they kind of get in here, but is it necessary to do it at a wedding scene in the beginning of the movie? Is there another way to do it more economically and cut out maybe half hour of this movie?
I'll say this. Weddings, funerals, they're great ways to get all of your cast together. And since we're going to have the three main characters on their own for the rest, I understand the desire to reintroduce everyone. God forbid this is your first Harry Potter movie, but if it is, this is the moment where you might start to find a footing.
Mm-mm, because we're meeting people I don't know. Elpheus Doog, I guess I'm saying that right. Somebody that wrote, like, Dumbledore's obituary and is going to start gossiping about his backstory and all of that. No, like, there are too many new characters. You bring back old characters to remind us. You don't say, oh, here's brothers we didn't meet. And here's, like, thieves that were part of this shell game. Like, no, this should be about callbacks. This should not be about throwing in characters we didn't get in so far.
Right, and later in this movie and later in the next movie, they do a lot of that. But here, I mean, also, wasn't the Burrow burned down last movie? I think it was. All of a sudden, it's back.
No, it's a new place. They're in a smaller farm.
Seems to me that they're calling it the Burrow.
No, I thought it was the exact same place. And again, I thought the burning of the Burrow last movie had no point. And now I guess they just went, Reparo, and it's back.
I guess so. Yeah, I mean, maybe it smells like smoke. I don't know. The morning of the wedding, it should be said, though, we do have the Scrimjaw scene with Get Bequeathed stuff. There's that funny Ginny makes her move scene with asking Harry to zip up the dress, and George is there watching it. There's some nice character moments. I thought the scene with Scrimjaw with the Hermione had a nice moment, and Ron had some nice moments. They're finding time in these new scenes with these new characters or the callback scenes that they do have to really showcase and give some breathing room for these characters that we don't always get, which I always applaud in the previous movies. I am enjoying those moments, even though I do acknowledge from a movie-making perspective and from a movie series perspective, they're doing some no-nos here in the way they're making the movie structured up top.
I mean, would it have killed them to go back to the school? Like, I feel like the school is such an orienting thing. And it's cool. Like, the idea that Snape is now the headmaster and it's maybe, you know, like, fully under the control of a ministry that's now working for Voldemort. Like, that would be interesting to explore a changed Hogwarts. I feel like you have Harry go off on his own. You have the other ones go back. And, like, we can cross parallel. Or maybe just Harry drops out and we see the school. I don't know. I feel like I have a lot of curiosities about these supporting characters, but the way they're coming off at some dumbass wedding is not it. Like, no, this is not how I want to meet them.
Whether it's devotion to the book or just the corner they painted themselves into with part six, they had Harry, Hermione, and Ron say, we're not coming back to school next year ahead of time. So they're stuck with that. But This movie, more than any other, does break away from Harry Potter's point of view. We get to follow other characters. The scene you mentioned with Voldemort's evil roundtable people and things. So you could have gone back, I suppose, and followed Neville and Ginny, but I'm not sure that would be better than the wedding. It would be different than the wedding.
We get one scene. Yeah, there's the train gets stopped, and that's all that we really see, is that it's hard for those people. But we, again, I think that's some of the stronger stuff that this whole saga has been doing, is talking about the way that things happened in World War II and finding this equivalency between wizards and muggles. Like, I feel like that would have been nice. And instead, yeah, we're going to get quests upon quests. What are they looking for? What devices are they using? I will just go ahead and say there's a lot about this that I didn't understand reading the book and now watching this movie.
Right. I do like, before we get to all the camping and all that stuff, though, they try to blend in and they go to Grimwald Place and they have that awesome scene in the diner with the two wizards attacking them. I like how the trio, I like how they're demonstrating in those scenes, the ones at Grimwald Place, and they figure out R.A.B. together, and they're at the diner scene, and they defeat those Death Eaters, how they work together, and how the three of them have their strengths. Ron is suddenly brave when he needs to be. Harry is contemplating, and Hermione is capable. But all three of them are good in a fight, and they complement each other very strongly. And when they work together, the three of them are stronger than one individual. And we're getting that early here in the movie and not so much in the middle. And I really do like that they have these scenes in here. The diner scene is not in the book. At least I don't remember it being in there. And I thought it was a great way to demonstrate to, you know, how these three are going to be working together and relying on each other for the next, you know, months of their lives.
I get that Harry's the chosen one. I get that Hermione's the smart one. I'm still not quite sure what Ron is, other than I kept thinking about, like, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, where Xander doesn't really have a purpose either, but then they're like, he's the heart. And so it's like, maybe Ron's the heart of the trio.
Yeah. They call you the heart when you aren't good at anything. But, okay, so you were teasing last time, what's R.A.B.? Can you guess R.A.B.? Who would remember that? I mean, I remember that Sirius Black had a brother that joined the Death Eaters, but, like, how this all played out with the locket and the fake locket and all of that. Brr.
Yeah, R.A.B. kind of, like, is one of those things they, again, also don't forget, when we had read the book and R.A.B. was at the end of that sixth book, one of the things we were talking about is, who is R.A.B.? Who is going to be a big deal in the next book? Oh, my God. And it was like, oh, it's Regulus Black. Okay, someone got it right. Good. And then, but, oh, he's dead. Oh, okay. And the locket, wait, he doesn't have the locket? Wait, oh gosh. So it kind of was like a dead end after a dead end after a dead end with this R.A.B. thing. And in the movie, it's just as bad.
I will admit, at the end of book six, when I was reading this, and I saw there was R.A.B., I did have this fear that they were just going to introduce a new character to be the new Dumbledore, to be the new guy giving them the tips that they needed for their quest. And so that it is Regulus Black, because I'd read the book before seeing movie six when we reviewed that last week, and I didn't remember at the end of book six who R.A.B. was, and then early in movie six, they dropped the name Regulus Black. I'm like, aha. So if you're really looking, it is there in six, but
you're not rewarded.
No.
I mean, it's not, oh, wow, it was some character we're never going to meet. Terrific. And some house elves are going to grab another character we haven't met in the movies and drag him in here. And as you say, all to find out that the locket, that everything that they did with that was just sort of this dumb dead end. And now we got to go break into the ministry.
I just want to say, before we get to the ministry, I thought the look of Creature this time was so much better than he was in two movies ago in book five. It's a different effects house this time. I think ILM did not do the special effects for this. I think a new place did. But whatever they did for Creature and Dobby later in the movie, I thought was better than we've seen them ever before. It has been quite a few years since the Chamber of Secrets, so Dobby, of course, would be improved. But here with Creature, I think he looks great, and I want to give credit where credit's due.
Not that he does a whole lot.
Right.
Not that he does a whole lot, no. No, and right, exactly. But the ministry scene is another opportunity to use the Polyjuice potion for some comedy and some lightheartedness, and it plays really well, a bit of a kind of a caper in the middle of this movie. And, of course, the set design is great. But these three kids pretending to be adults The adult actors pretending to be the kids overall do a pretty good job. Did you find this scene as fun as I did?
No.
He said no.
No, I hated this scene. It's a waste of time.
What? Okay, I really liked this scene. I thought it was a lot of fun. Dolores Umbridge, the fact that she survives is just a problem for me, because they kill Mad-Eye but let this one survive, but she's the biggest evil in all these movies. Forget Voldemort. Umbridge is the big bad. And so to be able to face off against her, to get back into the Ministry of Magic, to see in person the persecution of half-bloods and things.
The one joke I liked was that we're watching the opposite of a Salem witch trial. Like, they're gonna kill you for not being a witch. That was kind of funny.
That was kind of funny. But what about when Muggles attack the magazine and they have, it's raining in my office, have you tried an umbrella? I mean, that kind of stuff is fun to me. They don't really explain his name is Yaxley. They drop his name a few times later. It took me 2 times watching this movie to realize that was Yaxley. And I've seen this movie before. But there's a lot of good stuff here. When at the end, when they get chased out of there, I love that guy Yaxley is just pacing fast. And the way he zaps his wand at the kids is awesome. We haven't seen someone handle a wand that way before. That was really fun. And how Harry gets the chance to say, I will not tell lies to Umbridge again. And her Patronus is a cat. And how it's keeping the Dementors at bay. And there's so many little things going on here that just make this scene play really well to me. I love how Hermione's, well, not Hermione, it's the actress who's pretending to be Hermione, has that deer in a headlight look the entire time, which we've seen Emma Watson do quite a few times in this series. So it was really fun for me to see these kind of fun scenes. Mad-Eye Moody's eye is on her door, and they really recreate that well. That's straight out of the book. But Harry's distraction was from Wizard Weasley's. That was kind of fun.
Why do we want fun? I'm going to interrupt with that. Like, okay, you made many good points about what's the propaganda was kind of funny. It's Hitler. He's taking over. Like, why are we trying to make that pratfalls? I feel like I want this thing, Deathly Hallows, to get a little bit tense here. We've already had a funny, they swapped identities with the potion thing at the beginning. Like, another one?
To me, I want these movies to be fun. I mean, Vader and the Emperor were space Hitler. That doesn't mean the Star Wars films can't have some fun to them. These are kids' books that have gotten into teenage books, and I don't want the Diary of Hermione Granger with Hermione hiding under the floorboards from the Death Eaters, you know? I want to have some fun with these films.
Not only that, they're having the action scene up top, they're having the fun scenes up top, because we're going to have a whole lot of not that coming up. Majority of this movie doesn't have this kind of energy in it, right? Until the climax of this movie, when they get to Malfoy Manor, they don't have a whole bunch of this kind of stuff. There's not a lot of fun going on after this Ministry of Magic caper.
Agreed. But that's a different problem.
Well, I have bigger problems with when they apparate out of there and Ron gets splinched. They don't explain what splinching is in previous movies. If they do, I completely forgot.
They don't. They've never talked about splinching. And so I'd read the book, so I wasn't confused.
Right.
But I certainly wasn't fully expecting it either. It's the first time we're seeing it. They seem to shy away from really showing the gore. We get to see something happen to his arm. What exactly happened to his arm? I'm not so sure.
What splinching is that he doesn't get there completely. Like, he's part of him still stuck someplace else. And also, why are people in the ministry not dressed as wizards are in Hogwarts? Why are no one wearing robes? Everyone's wearing, like, normal-looking clothes. It's weird. That kind of stuff I don't understand more than I probably should. But there, again, they're assuming a lot on being loyal to the book and the movie universe. The scenes are showing a lot more in this first half of this movie of the things they decided were not necessary to keep in the movies. Now they're having to put them back in, and it's assuming a lot of the audience.
All right, Ron got hurt. I don't need to totally understand. Something bad happened when you're popping around. Apparating is what they call it. But, like, why does Ron get an attitude and walk away? Like, there's, like, the performances. Like, I feel like there are huge chunks of, like, arcs missing here. Like, it's just strange.
In the movie's defense, Stuart, I don't understand why he walked away in the book either.
Yeah, they go to lengths to explain that the locket has negative effects on all three of them. But Ron is grumpy before the locket stuff, I think, right? They try to destroy the locket and decide to wear it and take turns. But I think Ron and Hermione get mad at, and Hermione more in the book, but Ron's getting mad at Harry because there is no grand plan. And he's getting frustrated. And that's accentuated by the locket. But he's just getting more and more frustrated because he's the one who got injured and they went into the Ministry of Magic, into the Lion's Den. And they still are not anywhere closer to finishing this quest. And they're bickering among themselves.
And what is the quest? And again, I think I am Ron. I relate to Ron in this. What are you doing? What is going on? What is the tone? What is the focus?
Right. And so this issue of the book, and since they're being so loyal to the book, this portion of the movie has the same issues, even though they're better with, say, like when the Snatchers are outside the force field and they can smell Hermione. There are certain aspects of it that play better here, but it still doesn't make a heck of a lot of sense why we're spending so much time with not knowing what's going on instead of getting quicker to we figured this out. They do go on all the same beats they do in the book to the detriment of the movie. And then they add in a dancing scene, which made me very uncomfortable before they go to Godric's Hollow.
I liked that dancing scene. I thought it was cute. I thought it showed a moment of friendship between the two, that Hermione was really depressed and Harry's trying to cheer her up, and there's nothing in that dancing that seems at all romantic. I at no point felt like Harry and Hermione were becoming romantically involved. He was cheering her up with a very silly dance routine, and I thought it was kind of cute. I thought it was a nice moment for those actors to show a transition of emotion where they've been playing fairly one note so far.
Well, Ron certainly thought there was something going on. And I think we're supposed to, I think there's always been a lingering something between Hermione and Harry. But yes, they land on friendship, but they could have ended up together.
Yeah, I got a couple of moments there, a couple of looks from Radcliffe. And at the end of the dance, we look at each other and they walk away from each other. Like, if they were ever going to do something, it was that time kind of thing. And so that's what I got from that moment, which is nowhere in the books and nowhere in these movies. And so why even introduce that idea here, even though Ron's jumping to those conclusions and that keeps coming into play as, and Ron finally comes to grips with it himself at the end of this movie. But for goodness sake, why even bother even hinting at it with this uncomfortable dancing scene? What you're saying is true, Arnie. They play it very, and they have a lot of fun. You can see those smiles are genuine. These two old friends who've been working together for 10 years dancing in a tent. That's great. But as far as character goes, I was not happy with it.
It's not a dance scene. It's a feeling. It's a feeling of, as Ron said, I don't know where we're going. I don't know what the point is. There's all this just stuff that's happening. Like Harry just suddenly will grab his forehead and go, I'm having a psychic connection to Voldemort. And I'm sorry, Grigorovich? Like, is anyone going to understand like that Grindelwald and Grigorovich and the stealing of the wand and all of this? Like, woo-wee.
No. Not in this movie, no way.
Yeah, I will honestly say, not only if you've never seen a Harry Potter movie will you not understand, but even if you've only seen the Harry Potter movies, you won't understand what's going on. This requires you not only to read the book, but to study the book in order to translate these little moments into meaning.
I don't think that's true in the same way you're at. I think book five has that major problem. I think here with the Grigorovich stuff, I think that's all explained. Harry's getting the visions and then he explains it right afterwards to Hermione, or it gets explained when they get to Godric's Hollow.
There's like two wand makers. Like, it's confusing. We got John Hurt and then we got this other Russian guy and all. Like, no, just would it kill you to simplify and consolidate?
Well, they do. They say, Grigorovich, the wand maker? Yeah, the wand maker. Because there's more than one wand maker. There's Reeboks and Nikes. It's fine with me.
But you've read these books 8 times and you're steeped in this.
Right.
And so for you, seeing nuance is fun. Whereas someone trying to follow a story is going, what is going on?
I'm agreeing with you that this movie does that. And I've already said a couple of times where I completely agree with that aspect. Here, I don't see that problem because they clearly explain it, that Voldemort's on his own quest and Harry's getting visions on it, and Ollivander's in one of those visions and Grigorovich is in the next one. That's all. That's what I saw.
If they wanted to make it where this movie was shown from two points of view and we did see Voldemort's quest in parallel to Harry's quest, A, that would greatly help some of the really dry, long parts of this movie.
Yeah.
Yes.
And B, then you'd have time to go into this Grigorovich stuff better and really explain why he's needed instead of Ollivander and everything. But the fact that you've never mentioned Grigorovich before, we don't really have time with him here. He's just some guy screaming about a wand briefly. Is it fatal to this movie? Absolutely not. But it's something that's going to take more than one viewing at least to fully parse.
Well, help me out. What did happen with the wand? Some blonde guy stole a wand and he took it to this Godric Hollow or something? There's a picture of him here. I don't know what's important. Tell me.
So the guy who stole the Elder Wand was, we find out, because Harry goes to Godric's Hollow and they find Bathilda Backshot, who we learn is actually the snake. She has pictures of this guy in the house.
Right.
And it turns out that that was Grindelwald, who is the guy that Dumbledore partnered up with to get the Deathly Hallows. And extraneous information is the implied in the book, but nowhere near the movie, Dumbledore had a crush on. But that's neither here nor there for this movie.
Really? It was implied in the book because Rowling has said that she knew the whole time that Dumbledore was gay.
Yes, it's implied in the book that one of the reasons that, maybe because I know this, but especially this last time he read it for Books and Nachos, Dumbledore's was attracted to him and some of his decisions that he made that went against the family.
Who is he? I don't care about that. Like, you tell me what is happening in this scene. Yeah, all right, so we go to Godric's Hollow, which I do at least pick up is the place where Harry got zapped as a baby. It was maybe where he was born. It was certainly where he was attacked. It was where Voldemort was defeated. And so, again, I'm thinking, ooh, this is going to be some kind of showdown here. And yeah, some chick in a hood turns into a snake and it's over. I don't know what happened.
I wouldn't call an old lady a chick, but I understand your point. A woman in a hood lures them to a cottage or something and attacks them. Basically, it's a trap. Voldemort set a trap for Harry, knowing that he'd go there. And she had been dead for quite some time.
What are they looking for? They're looking for a hollow or a Horcrux. What are they looking? Do they know? Or they're just whatever, if we see something cool.
They are only looking for Horcruxes so far. They don't know about the Deathly Hallows until they get with Luna's dad later.
Although she spent some time looking in books and she's starting to put it together. But yeah, I think you're right.
Right. She finds the symbol on the gravestone and she's able to use the clues that she gets here, plus the book that's in Bathilda's house, which is the Dumbledore biography. Hermione is able to use that as well to put some pieces together for the mystery of what Dumbledore wants them to do, what the Deathly Hallows have to do with this, etc.
I thought for sure, if we were splitting this up, that there would be time to let this meaning come through, that we would be able to savor things, that we would understand every beat of where they were going. But the confusion that I had reading the story remains, maybe even worsens, watching the shorthand in this movie.
I'll agree that if I hadn't read the book, there would be a lot of questions I would be asking during this podcast, the ones you're asking. Because I've read the book, unfortunately, I'm not able to realize exactly how out of my depth I would be with some of this stuff. And going, basically, what I would get from all of this is, I think I really need to read that book if I care. If I care what this stuff is, I have to pick up a book.
Right.
So my other thing I will say, but with this Godric's Hollow scene, and we talked about this on Books and Nachos, but I think it's relevant here because the movie has the same issue. When Ron leaves and then through the scene with Godric's Hollow, the book loses its way completely in my mind. It's very hard to read that. I called it the slog of the book. And here in this movie, it doesn't do much better. It doesn't make as much sense as I want it to make in this movie as an adaptation of the book. Maybe I'm just missing something big here, but the snake scene and the attack was a fun scene to watch. I thought the snake looked good. I thought the light filter was weird, but that's okay. But the movie, for me, picks up again in the next scene when Ron returns and the sword. So the same issues I have with the book, I have with this movie, the narrative of what they're sticking to. I just don't know if the scene really works in the movie because it's not telling enough to be included.
Well, let's just ask the question. If they cut it, what would we lose? We would lose a chase scene. We would lose an attack that's kind of exciting.
Right.
I guess the thing that comes out of it is Hermione connects a gravesite with a symbol and she picks up a copy of the Dumbledore tell-all that she'll be reading throughout this and be able to fill in more of that portrait.
Correct. So it's a lot of good stuff for Hermione, and Harry gets to visit his childhood home, which is something that I kind of like that scene. But the whole thing with the snake and the old woman and things, that scene was creepily done, right? It was a nice kind of a horror scene kind of moment, which was kind of neat. So it was filmed pretty well. I'm just saying, I'm agreeing with you. The plot here is a little bit muddied. And would you be able to plant the other stuff there? Because again, the premise of this entire thing is we're part one and part two because they couldn't figure out a way or didn't want to figure out a way to condense this into one maybe longer movie. Instead of a 3-hour movie, they wanted to have two-hour movies, or one's 2.5 hours. But you get my point. Instead of doing a really, really long movie, like a Godfather 2, they decided to make two long movies. And do they have to have done that? Is there a way to condense this down? And right now, with this scene and all the other stuff that may be weird after Ron leaves, the same part of the book I don't like either. So maybe I'm carrying that over. But again, after they get out of this scene, the rest of the movie, I don't have any of these kinds of plotting problems with at all.
I don't think you're carrying it over from the book. My thought was, if you're abridging this book and you've had time, I mean, this is coming out 2010 and the sequel in 2011. So you've had a few years to deal with what Rowling wrote. You're not getting pages that you have to adapt immediately and rush to film, that you would be able to trim some of this stuff down. The Godric's Hollow stuff does have a little bit of interest in that you get a character moment with Harry's parents' graves and you see the sign of the Deathly Hallows again. But the fact that we are going to spend a good 45 minutes of this movie, I think, with Ron, Hermione, and Harry camping, Ron leaves, Ron comes back. It is as hard to watch in this movie as it is to read in that book. And I realize that my strong negativity towards that book may be a minority opinion because millions of people worship every word Rowling wrote. But for me, this area of the movie drives home something very clearly. This should not be two movies. There should be 1 3-hour movie, and there is 1 hour of material that matters in this first film.
And I would say that my thought is not condensing it. My thought is explaining it. Yeah, strangely enough, 750 pages is not enough to tell the story of that seventh novel. So all I'm asking for is coherence. And that's the struggle. I can't have fun with these scenes if I don't know what is going on. It becomes like too disorienting to just be like, oh, we're just in a room with a snake now. Now we're under a lake, whatever.
Well, I like the lake scene. I like the doe. I think all of that works completely. I think if they decided that Ron stayed and they didn't go to Godric's Hollow and they have the doe there sometime after the snatchers go away, right? So they had that scene when they try to destroy the locket, and then they give some sort of, they've been there for a while montage, something to do like that, and then they go right to the doe and the sword. Because what they're also trying to do is, they're trying to say, and Hermione yells at Ron, you've been gone for months. They're trying to say they've been at this for months, and they're getting nowhere. So there has to be another way they could do that for us. But then again, I had the same problem with Lord of the Rings. You know, how many more times are I going to watch them walk? So here they chose to keep the Godric's Hollow scene in. If they cut that out and then went right to the doe scene, I think that would solve a lot of problems. And all you have to do is figure out how to get her the copy of the book that puts things in perspective. And that's all she had to do. Maybe the snatchers dropped a copy in the woods when they hit the shield that she put up. That's how simple it could be to her get the book that will explain a lot more, because the Deathly Hallows symbol was already dropped at the wedding and it's already at the top of her copy of the book that Dumbledore gave her. If you cut out this Godric's Hollow sequence, I think the movie could work just fine.
And I don't know why it's taking months. They can apparate. They can jump around. Like, what? They're not walking anywhere. Like, so
they don't know where they're going, though.
Right. That should not be. I'm just going to assert that strongly. Harry should have a plan. It could end up being a false lead. It could lead him down a, you know, dangerous path. But we should not have people just, like, popping around going, Horcrux, Horcrux. Like, no, that's, you look dumb.
Get your Horcrux here, everybody. Popcorn, Horcruxes. I think that without Hermione and Ron, Harry can't do this. We've watched 6 movies that show us that Ron and Hermione are necessary for Harry to get to the end point. Once Harry gets to the end point, he can handle himself, right? Once he knows what's going on and he has an idea of what's going on, he can handle himself. It's that solving the mystery portion that Ron and Hermione have always seemed to be what Harry needs, and that's why the trio is together for one last ride.
I only think of that true as the first book. If that's been in other adventures, I don't remember it. But to get through all those little chessboard traps and everything, yes, I remember Hermione and Ron helping, but I don't remember that in any other time.
So they get the sword out of the water, and here's another scene I find extremely uncomfortable. It's naked Harry and naked Hermione making out in the vision that comes out of the locket when they're opening it. Wow, that was something I don't think I ever needed to see.
How old are these actors at this point?
I guess they're legal age, but it just felt weird. And then they put the eye makeup they had on Hermione too was vixen-y. A lot of choices they made with this vision. I get what they were doing. It's helping Ron, I guess, put away his demons. Character-wise, I get it. Just the visuals of those two making out. And again, I don't know if Daniel Radcliffe knows how to kiss people. Every time we see him kiss, he seems uncomfortable. And in this scene, it was even worse because they were naked in steam. It was weird. It was just a weird, weird feeling to watch that.
It made me raise my eyebrows. I can't say I had the extreme visceral reaction you did, but it was definitely making me think of Blue Lagoon.
Okay.
At any rate, so what did they learn? They've learned that they can now destroy it with a sword, and that they know that a symbol that seems to be popping up a lot is going to be explained by the publisher of the Quibbler.
Yes, the Quibbler, yes, who we met at the wedding earlier in the movie.
But we never really made a big deal out of the Quibbler in the previous movies the way that it had been in the books. So the fact that he's publisher of the Quibbler seems less important than he's Luna's dad.
Correct. I love their little dancing scene at the wedding. They're dancing together like they're with their hands together, and they clearly cut from the same cloth, and he's a joyous man. And when we see him now, he's a broken man, and we learn why. I felt that they adapted this scene quite well from the book. They cut out some stuff here from the book, which was good. Nothing hugely important, but I kind of like how they adapted his character and how he, the Deathly Hallows scene with the cool kind of like shadow animation was a cool choice to tell that story. Did you guys enjoy the animated sequence of the Deathly Hallows?
Very Tim Burton-y. I wondered how they'd do it. I did wonder, would it be reenacted? Would we have actors in that part? Would it just be a dramatic reading from Emma Watson, or would it be some kind of animated tale? And the way they did it, it was certainly stylish, and I can't say I loved it. I didn't hate it, though. It was nice and unique.
I mean, it's hard to untangle my feelings about adding the Deathly Hallows to the complications, to the way that the fable is presented. Yes, it's lovely to see the shadow puppets. It's a nice way to tell you, pay attention to this story within a story. And yeah, now we're checking off wand and invisibility cloak and stone. And when you put them all together, it forms the symbol. If that were the movie, if that were the mystery, this would be a nice moment. But because that is now being told while we're supposed to be looking for seven other things, grr.
Mm.
The thing is, they're not sure what they're trying to find even. And so I keep thinking that the Hallows will play in. Like, maybe since they have no idea where the Horcruxes are, you wouldn't need them if you had the Deathly Hallows or something like that. It unfortunately proves to be a distraction, though, because, I mean, they've had one Deathly Hallow since the very first movie, and it's not made them invincible. So it sounds like you don't want the Resurrection Stone. It's like the monkey's paw.
I mean, is that different from the Philosopher's Stone? Like, I mean, didn't we already do that story? It just feels, again, it feels like Rowling is trying to bring it all together, but realizing she didn't put it all in. And so now it's got to come now.
I think the Deathly Hallows animation's great. I think the idea behind the Deathly Hallows of becoming a master of death, meaning this is a tool you can use to overthrow Voldemort, on top of the Horcruxes, if that's not enough, you have these tools. And will that be enough? Will that be the road they're going to go down? Will they decide we need these instead of the Horcruxes to defeat Voldemort? And do we have to worry about Voldemort going after any or all of these items? And it turns out he just wants the Elder Wand, thinking that's going to be enough. But obviously he already had the Resurrection Stone and didn't realize it was a Resurrection Stone. Right? If he knew that was a Resurrection Stone, he would have kept it.
I guess.
He had the Resurrection Stone? Voldemort did?
Yes, it's the ring that was destroyed by Dumbledore in the last movie.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I didn't put that together, but it is said, at least in the book repeatedly, Voldemort doesn't consider that anything to be worried about. He's only worried about power, so...
Right.
I guess. Again, you know, it's one thing to be complex. It's another thing to be cluttered. And I feel like, yeesh. Again, keep in mind, I'm watching this. Now, I have read the rest of the book, but when I watched this, I had not. I was in a ball of confusion.
Okay. So right after that, after they get the thing, after the tail and all that, and they escape from Luna's family's house, they have that snatcher chase, which is all over the posters and all over the previews. They get running through the forest with the Steadicam. My daughter and I had a funny laugh, though. We have this thing in the house. I'm sure you guys had one when you were kids. At least your school recommended you have a fire safety plan, in that when you are in a house fire at the house, there's a tree out front, or we have a plan. Okay, if you can't get out the front door, go to the back door and go to this neighbor's. If there's a fire in the house, we have a plan that we know where we're going to meet up in case there's a bad thing to happen. Ron, Hermione, and Harry did not come up with a fire safety plan so they could all just apparate separately and meet up someplace else. If they did that, they would not have been captured and they would not have to worry about it. All you gotta do, man, just fire safety plan.
I thought they did apparate. So they're just running away from the burning Lovegood home?
Well, they were running away. I'm talking about the next scene when Hermione decides they can't get away and she zaps Harry with the disfigurement charm.
Yeah, but they did apparate there. That's where they've been camping.
Yes.
They apparated there, but then they didn't apparate again. They kept on running because they didn't want to get separated or something like that, and they didn't have a plan. All I'm saying is...
Nobody's got a plan in this movie, okay? Nobody.
Clearly. But that gets them to Malfoy Manor, and I guess the climax of the movie is being trapped in the Malfoy Manor and escaping from there.
Does not feel like the climax. I will say that when credits rolled after this, I was a little bit shocked. It was feeling like the next step along the way. At least things were happening. I was happy for that. But this felt like, okay, we're finally getting some characters back into here. Luna's there. Ollivander is there. We haven't seen him since the first movie.
Right.
Everybody should be forgiven if they don't remember who he was.
True. And we see the Malfoys again looking worse for wear. Bellatrix is back. And there's some serious stuff going on here. They're trapped in a dungeon. Hermione is tortured, strangely, with a knife, not the wand. In the book, Wormtail kills himself with his metal hand.
I was hoping for that here. I was looking forward to seeing that reenacted on screen. But as far as I can tell, he lived through the scene.
Yeah, he fell over. We never see him again. Spoiler alert, we don't see him in the next movie at all. So, yeah, he just, I guess, is knocked out here. His wand is taken away from him. Dobby is a huge hero.
He can run off with Umbridge, and the two of them can live happily in secret.
There you go. I guess they didn't want him choking himself because it'd be maybe too dark, or how would you visualize that for a kid's movie? I don't know, it's PG-13.
Star Wars set Anakin on fire. You could have him choke himself.
But is it necessary for the plot or what we're seeing? It gets him out of the way.
Yes, he is the direct cause of Harry's parents' death. In the rules of drama like this, he needs to die.
And he doesn't die.
But who even remembers that?
Well, I do.
I mean, again, I forgot about Wormtail. Like, once we got Voldemort, we don't care about him.
Sure.
But this is a Draco scene. Just to figure out what's going on here, Draco knows that this is Harry, but Hermione has zapped his face so that it's all swollen, and nobody else can tell that it's them?
Yeah, they don't look for the lightning bolt scar. I mean, you'd think that would be the telltale is, yeah, he's got a lightning bolt scar on his forehead. This is him.
The Snatcher did. He can't really see it very well. It's distorted. They show a shot of that. It doesn't make any sense to me is they all know magic, right? And someone said, oh, maybe his face was distorted or something with a charm.
Yeah.
Why not just take a charm and reverse it? I mean, what's the worst that's going to happen to make his face look worse? If it's actually his face, then, oh, nothing happened. I guess it wasn't a mask, or I guess it wasn't a charm. Why not just try to do it that way instead of just trying to torture out of Hermione and throw the guys in the dungeon? But what really does, it's a nice moment for Draco. He does not want to tell them it's Harry. He does not want to be responsible for the death of Harry Potter here. And that's very interesting to me, considering how much they don't like each other. But it shows that Draco is having a change of heart, doesn't want to be involved in any of this, just like his dad doesn't.
Or Draco can never pull the trigger. Like, Draco just is wimpy and can't kill.
Sure, that also.
I can't decide how much of a redemption Draco deserves, really. I mean, he's never been primeval, he's always just been annoying evil, but he also has signed up with the Death Eaters. He couldn't kill Dumbledore, which makes me think he's in for a redemption, and this is a step along the way.
Right.
Yeah. And this is Dobby's big scene as well. Like, his finest moment may be that squeaking sound and nobody can tell what it is. And then they look up and see him in the chandelier unscrewing it and chaos erupts.
Yeah. I like that part. I like the knife flying right through this stuff. I liked a lot about this final confrontation thing. I think it plays really well. I think it's filmed really well. I like what Helena Bonham Carter's doing there.
She's always good. I really do like her. Again, another huge millennial tier moment. The death of Dobby really got them.
Really?
Oh, yeah, big time. It was a huge deal in the book. J.K. Rowling, every year she would apologize for someone killing someone just for that. And it was kind of like, it's not tongue-in-cheek, but it's like, yeah, I'm sorry I had to kill him, but narratively speaking, it makes sense, X, Y, Z. But she admits that, you know, killing Fred later in the movie and killing Dobby here, it's hard for her to do that, but it was necessary for the story. Again, if Dobby is an option for Harry this entire time, then it's going to make it easier for Harry to rely on yet another person, or another, in this case, an elf. So Dobby has this moment. He's a free elf. He uses his freedom and helps Harry when Harry needs him most, and then he dies.
Yeah, I'm on TikTok enough to see a lot of videos referencing Dobby's death. A lot.
So for me, it's like when I got older, when I was in college, and then after that, when I was first on social media, Artex from The Neverending Story, the horse, when he dies in the swamps of sadness, that's what I equate this to for my childhood or my younger years. That when I got older, I realized how much that really affected me and other people did. It affected them as well. I guess Dobby is their Artex, because I don't think the kids nowadays are watching Neverending Story, but I digress.
Yeah, but I mean, you can now watch that scene and be like, why did I fall for it, right? I mean, like, this Dobby scene is not very good. Like, it looks like beckoning me. Like, the character looked like Nakami, the death scene, the whole, like, what, close his eyes, all of that, like, I...
Was there a death scene in Mac and Me? I haven't seen Mac and Me. Was there a horrible death scene?
Oh, yeah, it's E.T. It's E.T. and a McDonald's. Yeah, they do it all.
Brock, you complimented the CGI for Creature. They did not improve it for Dobby.
I thought in his first few scenes they did. I thought he looked pretty good here. I didn't seem to matter to me. Also, at the end of the death scene, it kind of looked like he was actually holding something in his hand and they animated the face or something. I thought that was pretty cool. I believed that. I believe that more than I believe when they were transforming back from being Harry and they're hugging each other earlier in the movie when they come back from that first broom ride and everyone was hurt or recovering. When they're all changing, when they're hugging each other, that looked more dodgy than Dobby does here. I thought Dobby looked just fine here, in fact. I had no problem with Dobby in these scenes.
I'm just saying he doesn't look photo real. I'm saying that if you want me to cry for your creation, I need to believe your creation is in three-dimensional space.
You didn't think Harry was holding an actual dying elf in that scene, in the close-up, because I thought he was holding something in that scene. I really did.
He might have been holding something, but I never believed in the face of Dobby.
I felt bad for Radcliffe. I really did. That he had to act that scene out. It hurt me to see him do it. But again, that just tells you my age, because you're right. You're telling me a whole generation was traumatized. For them, this was E.T. dying.
Yeah.
And E.T. came back to life. Harry gets a resurrection stone, and Dobby's still dead.
Well, the resurrection stone doesn't mean that, but I guess we'll talk about that next time. Anyway, the movie ends with Voldemort breaking into this beautiful Frank Lloyd Wright-type tomb.
Is this on Hogwarts land?
I don't know where it is. I would think it would be on Hogwarts land, but I don't know. I have no idea. Wouldn't it be kind of cool if it was under the Whomping Willow, though? That would be kind of neat.
It would be, but I just wish that we'd had this shot with Hogwarts in the background, you know? I thought I understood that he was buried on Hogwarts. Maybe that's just in the book, but otherwise he's just nowhere. I'm trying to get a place of where this is, and if it is on Hogwarts ground, it just would have been nice to see the castle. I think that would have added to the image of the breaking of the tomb.
Sure, I agree with that. That's not a bad idea. And he lifts the wand up and shoots into the air. Voldemort has the most powerful wand in the land.
Which is funny, because I did think, I have the power! When he's shooting it up in the air.
How can you not think about that? And then credits roll. So the movie itself ends here, which should be noted, they're making part one and part two, but this part in the book is like 2/3 of the book in, I would think, something like that. It's more than halfway for sure. And that's because the next movie, they have a lot more ground to cover, or at least a lot more things they want to show us to conclude the story. But where else would you end part one if you don't end it right here? Because everything else starts to cascade with the Horcruxes and the Battle of Hogwarts. So as a part one, do you end it with him getting the wand? To me, it's hard to understand where exactly you should end it if it's not here. Did you have another thought? Is this a nice, solid way to lead into the next one? Was the Elder Wand of Voldemort getting the Elder Wand with all those flashbacks you guys said didn't mean anything to you, with the extra wand maker, etc.? I think that was leading up to this moment here that, oh god, he has that object that's going to make him invincible. Uh-oh, now the stakes are even higher. Did that play?
Makes perfect sense. You want to end with your characters at the lowest point, you know?
I completely agree with you. Dobby's death, and then the guy has the powerful wand that he's seeking.
Mm-hmm.
It's the place to end it.
They got the invisibility cloak and they got the sword, right? So, like, they're winning in the terms of the Deathly Hallows.
No, the sword's not a Deathly Hallow, and they haven't broken most of the Horcruxes yet.
The sword's not a Deathly Hallow?
Or a Horcrux. It's just a magic sword. You know, if you read the screenwriting book, Save the Cat, it tells you that there's always the whiff of death moment, and I think that's where you stop it, and the whiff of death often has a real death. In this case, it's Dobby, and all seems lost. It's your Empire Strikes Back kind of moment. The crew is together, but they're not sure what to do next. Yeah, this is where you end it if you feel you must make this two movies, and I will never believe this should be.
So, Stuart, Arnie, do you recommend Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 1? Stuart.
No. Yes. I mean, you've heard me. If you've heard me say anything, you've heard me swing insults at this. Are we sure M. Night didn't sneak in here and direct some of this? Because it has got the narf-narf and poo-poo of Lady in the Water. Like, it is so ludicrous, so unsatisfying, so many misdirections, things just happening because... Like, I didn't recommend 5 and 6, but that was because they were a mixed bag. They were things that were hit and miss. But this movie is pretty much all miss. Like, it is the first truly bad Harry Potter movie. And I don't care how much gets explained in the next one, I would never recommend that anyone sit through what I just watched. This is a terrible film.
Arnie.
Given that you just pointed out you didn't recommend 5, 6, or 7, I wonder if it's this director that's your problem in the end, Stuart, and if we'll never see a Green Arrow out of you again, if those Fantastic Beasts might not be so fantastic after all.
I like Stay to Play. I saw his miniseries.
But in regards to Deathly Hallows Part 1, obviously this is a not recommend because this is a movie I don't feel should exist. So I can't recommend a movie that I would like erased from history, but it's not that I hate it. I do think that this has some high moments. I really like it when things are happening, when they're in the Ministry of Magic, when they're in the Malfoy house. It's about it, but during those two scenes, those are really good scenes.
That's two more than I can give them. Yeah.
What about the seven Harrys and the broomsticks and the Thestral scene in the beginning?
Yeah, that was fun too. So there's three scenes and then a lot of problems that come straight out of the book. You had a chance to fix it here, and instead you actually worsened it, as Stuart has pointed out, with the amount of needless complexity introduced through characters that are there for a moment and gone. Mundungus was just introduced in scene one to then tell where the locket is later. He doesn't even have the locket. There's so many ways this could be tightened and abridged. It's on the weaker side of not recommend because I do really enjoy the scenes where things are going on, But there's so much doldrums here. Yeah, it's Harry Potter and the Deathly pacing. Not recommend.
I would have started this movie with the Tale of the Three Brothers, with the animation. So I wouldn't have started with Scrimjar. I wouldn't even start it with the three kids before the title. So I would have the Deathly Hallows to start the movie. Then you have them all leaving their residences after that, after the title. And then you go right into the movie. Because the Deathly Hallows, if it needs to be included, could have be like a pall that's set over this whole thing. And that would have been a cool way to do it. I would not have included Mundungus. I would have been able to tighten this up a little bit as well. When you have a movie called The Godfather Part 2, they don't call The Godfather Part 1, right? They made Part 2, but they didn't go into Part 1 knowing they're going to make Part 2, right? This movie knows they're going to make a Part 2, and this movie very much feels like the beginning of a long movie. For all of its flaws and all the problems I have and how you could have tightened it up, I would have preferred, yes, a nice, long 3-hour and 25-minute Harry Potter movie over having two separate movies so we can tighten this thing up a little bit, or maybe have this be 90 minutes or definitely not crack the 2-hour mark. But if you make it 90 minutes, you could really argue, do you need to have it at all, as Arnie is saying. So I'm hearing the frustration. I understand all of it. I'm going to weekly recommend it because there's enough here for me as a Harry Potter fan to enjoy. I do like the character moments so much. And for my complaints about the movies I haven't liked as much as other ones, my big issue is the characters aren't landing. And here, they're having so many opportunities for the characters to land. Now, again, the issue I have with the book, the big issue I have with the book is that slog portion when Ron's not there and they go to Godric's Hall and all that. And those problems are not fixed here. But when it works, it really does work for me. And watching it twice for this review, I really was able to enjoy not only the characterizations, not only the acting, I was really enjoying some of the cinematography and some of the music was really good too. So I do like what they did. It's definitely a flawed movie, no question about it. But my issues with 5 and my issues with 2 are much worse than my issues here with Deathly Hallows Part 1. So it definitely is a Part 1 of a bigger story. And I'm looking forward to discussing Part 2 with you guys on our next podcast. But it's a weak Green Arrow from me.
Let me ask more at Stuart, because you didn't recommend this so strongly. When we see Part 2, is it possible you could take this as one whole 4.5-hour, 5-hour movie and recommend both parts together? Or is this so bad that even if the second half is really good, you just couldn't abide? Could Part 1 be redeemed?
No, absolutely not. Anything that is like this, attached to anything else, is bad.
So, if viewing this as one 5-hour movie, Part 2 couldn't possibly be good enough.
Correct. Yeah, there's nothing they could do in the next 2 hours to save how awful I've experienced the first two.
Okay, well then I'm glad we're not looking at it as one movie. We will view Part 8 on its own.
Yeah, now they also are asking us to view it as two different movies. If even though it says Part 1 and Part 2, it was filmed as one movie. I like to think of it as one long movie separated into, like, digestible chunks. It's kind of like a mini-series on TV, if you will, with Part 1 and Part 2. It's meant to be watched together, but they didn't release it together. They released it, what, 10 months apart, right?
Well, my thinking is like Kill Bill. That was one movie that no studio wanted to release at that length, so Tarantino cut it in half, but it's one movie. So I'm saying if this were one movie...
Right. And there also, and we'll talk about it next time, the tones of the first Kill Bill and the second Kill Bill are completely different. There's definitely a tonal shift from this movie and the next movie, as we will discuss on our next podcast. Maybe that's better, maybe that's worse, but definitely if it's one long movie, maybe it would be kind of cool if they released this movie one day as a single movie, Deathly Hallows, together. That would be interesting to watch straight through.
For you.
Especially if they edited it down, like, you know how Coppola has done The Godfather as one, all three movies as one edited down giant movie?
Okay, yeah. I have never watched that, but yes, I've heard about it, you know.
And he mostly cut out of Part 3?
Yeah, I tend not to return to Part 3. So I just want to say I am looking forward to our next conversation, given how this one went, to see if Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2 can stick the landing for the film series. And I want to thank both of you for joining me in this conversation, but I also want to thank you, the patrons, for helping us have these conversations. It's because of people like you that our podcast can continue. We are a podcast with has no sponsors and no ads, so we rely on our listeners to help us continue, and so a big thank you for taking this ride along with us. Until next time, when we discussed part two of the Deathly Hallows, Mischief Managed.
Now, if you two don't mind, I'm going to bed before either of you come up with another clever idea to get us killed, or worse, expelled.
She needs to sort out her priorities.
Once again, thank you for supporting Now Playing.
I think that might have been the best moment of my life.
We hope you enjoyed the show.
Bet you loved that, didn't you, Potter?
It's your support that keeps Now Playing operating.
You will find that help will always be given at Hogwarts to those who ask for it.
Go to booksandnachos.com each week to hear our hosts review the original novels on which these movies are based.
I didn't know you could read.
And come back to nowplayingpodcast.com next Tuesday for another all-new movie review podcast.
You'll stay with me
until the end.
Help us spread the word about this show by leaving a 5-star review on Stitcher, Podbean, iTunes, or your podcast store of choice.
This is perhaps the most important memory I've collected.
Want more reviews like this one? In the archives section of nowplayingpodcast.com, you'll find more than 1,000 in-depth movie reviews from our panel of hosts.
Let's finish this the way we started it. Together!
On our site, you can hear reviews for every installment in the world's biggest film franchises, including the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Star Wars, Spider-Man, Batman, X-Men, James Bond, Middle Earth, Jurassic Park, Fast and Furious, and Transformers.
If you listen carefully enough, the past whispers to you.
Need more Now Playing? Subscribe to our In Focus weekly newsletter for exclusive digital download giveaways, celebrity interviews, behind-the-scenes insights, and more. Sign up through the subscribe page on our website and get it delivered to your inbox every Friday.
This is beyond anything I imagined.
You can also compare notes with us on Letterboxd. Go to letterboxd.com/nowplaying to see what our hosts are watching when we're not recording podcasts.
Every great wizard in history has started out as nothing more than what we are now. If they can do it, why not us?
And follow Now Playing on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and our YouTube channel.
It is the quality of one's convictions that determines success, not the number of followers.
Now Playing Podcast is produced by Arnie Carvalho.
Do you know why I admire you? More perhaps than any man I know. You do not seek power or popularity. You simply ask, is a thing right?
Associate produced by Jason Latham.
His indispensable assistant.
Now Playing is edited by Heath, Santiago, and Arnie.
Has it ever crossed your brilliant mind that I don't want to do this anymore?
Whether it has or hasn't is irrelevant. You agreed. Nothing more to discuss.
Artwork by Joe, Justin, and Arnie.
I think it is clear that we can expect great things from you.
Now Playing credits read by Brock.
You're saying it wrong. It's Leviosa, not Leviosa.
The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the views of Venganza Media Incorporated.
Words are, in my not-so-humble opinion, our most inexhaustible source of magic, capable of both inflicting injury and remedying it.
Venganza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with, and this podcast has not been prepared, approved, or licensed by any entity that created the film analyzed herein.
Dobby never meant to kill. Dobby only meant to maim or seriously injure.
All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review, and no infringement is intended.
Oh, you're gonna regret this. Then you bloody chicken.
Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of and may not be used without the express written permission of Vinganza Media Incorporated.
Sort of exciting, isn't it? Breaking the rules.
Now Playing is a Vinganza Media production, copyright 2022, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Vinganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
Let us hope that Mr. Potter will always be around to save the day.
Don't worry, I will be.
Ridiculous!
Ridiculous!
I'm kind of chomping at the bit here to get talking about this, so Arnie, how about we get a plot summary so we can dive into part one of the Deathly Hallows? When you're ready.
Sorry, I have a lot of notes, and
it's fine.
Was not prepared to jump to the plot summary that fast.
Yeah, everything else I want to say is about the movie, so I don't know what else to say.
Agreed. I have any pre-business, Sam.
Yeah.
Ridiculous!
And we see Voldemort gets the Elder Wand, taking it from the dead cold hands of Dumbledore's corpse, as credits roll.
Like Charlton Heston, he can have his guns out of his cold, dead hands.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Ridiculous!
Ridiculous!
They got the invisibility cloak and they got the sword, right? So, like, they're winning in the terms of the Deathly Hallows.
No, the sword's not a Deathly Hollow, and they haven't broken most of the Horcruxes yet.
The sword's not a Deathly Hollow?
Or a Horcrux. It's just a magic sword.
Oh, fuck this.
They need the sword to break the Horcruxes.
Never mind. I'm done. Drop the mic.
Yeah, clearly.
Come on, you saw the story. There's a cloak, a stone, and a wand.
I thought that one of them got a sword. No, he got his throat slit. I can't keep track of this shit. I really can't.
Ridiculous.
Ridiculous.